From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines. And let's get your weekend off on the right foot with this great show called Coast to Coast AM. Here's what's happening. New research has boiled down the most probable order in which COVID-19 symptoms first appear. Now, the earliest sign of the coronavirus will most likely be a fever in infected patients, followed by a cough and then muscle pain, according to a study conducted by the University of Southern California, published in the Frontiers in Public Health Journal just a day ago. Just thought you want to know that. The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases Director, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said this week, there's no reason that Americans can't vote in person for the 2020 presidential election so long as voters follow proper social distancing guidelines amid the coronavirus pandemic. By the way, the post office, everybody's complaining about the mail and saying they might not even be able to make the deadline. Let's check in with Dr. Jerome Corsi, who's looked at the coronavirus for us up to date. Jerry, what do you have for us?
Well, I think, George, the next big hurdle is the opening of schools. And this is going to be very contentious because people are concerned children will get COVID-19. And I'm still considering that just by December, we may have a new virus hitting, which might be COVID-20. We're not finished with this yet. And I continue to encourage people to take a look at the hydroxychloroquine issue. We have a free ebook right now on CorsiNation.com with some of the top research on hydroxychloroquine, including articles published in the American Journal of Epidemiology by Dr. Harvey Risch, who is a Yale faculty member, an epidemiologist who's got quite a reputation. 15-page resume, and I think people will find the actual clinical evidence on hydroxychloroquine and zinc may be the best preventative and early treatment for the disease that we have available.
What do you think of the Russian vaccine called Sputnik?
I'm skeptical, George, of all vaccines because we have not yet had a vaccine for even the AIDS disease, which another virus. It's very difficult to get an effective vaccine for viruses, and Dr. Fauci is saying that the Moderna vaccine may only be 50-50.
That's right.
And it may not be, you know, 50-50, you get the vaccine from Moderna, and 50-50, you could still get COVID-19. I don't think we're going to get a vaccine that's more effective than the average seasonal flu shot. So I'm very skeptical that we're going to solve this problem with a vaccine.
And what's new with Corsi Nation, Jerry?
Well, we're doing a lot of things. The TeleMD program, take a look at it. We're not selling hydroxychloroquine, but it's an interview with a doctor that can prescribe hydroxychloroquine even for prevention. And it's just exploding. It's doubled or tripled in size in the last month. CorsiNation.com, TeleMD, And please, George, get the free ebook. It's a very good ebook with the current clinical research and this Dr. Risch's analysis of hydroxychloroquine, I think, is very important. Yale epidemiologist.
Thank you, Jerry. Have yourself a great weekend. The Pentagon is forming a new task force to investigate UFOs that have been observed by U.S. military craft, according to two defense officials. The Deputy Secretary of Defense, David Norquist, will help oversee the task force, which is expected to be officially unveiled in the next few days, according to the officials. Previous efforts to look into what the Pentagon dubs unidentified aerial phenomena were led by the U.S. Navy, as many of the undocumented encounters and documented encounters involved their aircraft. It's time for Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center for his weekly report. Well, it sounds like we're getting closer to learning more about UFOs, Peter, doesn't it?
It looks that way, George, and I suspect that governments have been studying the phenomenon since the 1940s.
Yep.
And probably going back to the First World War, there were some incidents that deserved attention back then. But as was also the case last week, the past 7 days have been another very busy week in the field of ufology, with almost 250 new reports having been submitted to the hotline.
Huge.
last Friday, August 7th, and which are now or soon will be posted to my website. But before I address some of those new reports, I'd like to touch on a type of sighting that's being reported with a surprising frequency and that I wanted to discuss during my last update,
okay,
which I didn't have time for at the in the final analysis. Many witnesses, and many of them with impressive credentials, are reporting daytime sightings of objects that they perceive to be not only at high altitude, but very large. And here's the kicker, George. The objects appear to remain absolutely stationary at high altitude for many hours at a stretch. If they were just regular scientific balloons or balloons of any type, almost certainly they would drift with the prevailing winds, I argue. Over the past couple of years, I've reported to the Coast audience perhaps two or maybe three such cases, but I've always conjectured that the objects, strange though they were, probably were high-altitude helium-filled balloons, perhaps sponsored by the Google Corporation or for relaying radio signals, mm-hmm, or part of a government project. But based on several similar reports, I'm not sure we know what these objects are. And that leads me to my first report that was submitted early this week by a gentleman from Idaho. He reports that this past Sunday, August 9th, he was hiking in the White Clouds National or White Cloud Wilderness area near Stanley, Idaho, with five other adults, and they saw an object at 50 minutes past noon. They became aware of it, approximately the apparent size of Jupiter, but in what the author of the report describes as bluebird sky and full sunlight conditions. The reason I feel it's a noteworthy case is that the group of hikers continued to observe the object for 7 hours, George.
That's a long time.
The object appeared to the witnesses not to move relative to the Earth. There's several other reports posted or soon will be posted to my website for similar sightings. One I'll just close with, a woman during the tropical storm Isaiah reported a similar incident in which she claims, anyway, to have seen an object remaining motionless in the stormy sky of Isaiah. How that can be the case, I don't know. I've got several other reports, but I'll hang on to them till next week, George.
You got it. Thank you. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. His website, ufocenter.com. Up next, retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Randall back with us as we talk about more UFO cases, the official investigations of UFOs, and some other incredible stories next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Let me tell you about our guest who's with us for the next couple hours. Kevin Randall, retired Army Lieutenant Colonel, served in Vietnam as a helicopter pilot and aircraft commander. Thank you for serving, Kevin. In 2003, he deployed to Iraq as an intelligence officer, served on active duty with the Army and later the Air Force. He was a member of the Iowa National Guard on his deployment into the Middle East. He retired from the National Guard back in 2009. Kevin's interest in UFOs began as a teenager when he investigated a sighting while living in Colorado. His big question then was if the object had been sharply defined or had been a ball of light, what could it have been? From that point on, he has investigated hundreds of sightings around the country, including nearly three decades researching the events in Roswell. Kevin Randall, back on Coast to Coast. Kevin, and you, are you okay? I heard you got blasted by weather in Iowa.
I am sitting here in the dark.
Oh,
we have no electricity.
Whereabouts are you? Des Moines or
Cedar Rapids, Iowa?
Uh-huh. Know it well.
I think we took the brunt of the storm. The city was just devastated. There's, I think, 98% of the county is without power.
Oh, my God. And that's been for a couple days, hasn't it?
108 hours now.
Jeez. I had heard that hundreds of thousands of crop acres also got devastated.
The we couldn't get out of our house for a while off our street because there was a tree across the street. We were trying to get to the store, and we had to keep detouring because all the trees were down. Traffic lights were blown off into the distance. Power lines are down. Cell towers are down. The only thing that seems to be working is the telephone, the landline. Not
Thank
the
God. Let's keep our fingers crossed. I'm in St. Louis right now, Kevin, and we got some of what you got after the fact, but not nearly what you folks got. Just horrendous. But let's hope you get back to normal again, if you can. Cedar Rapids is a great little town.
They were saying unofficially the top wind speed was 145 miles an hour.
My God.
It's what's called an inland hurricane. And, of course, it didn't last for 24 hours or whatever. It lasted for maybe an hour, but it was just unbelievable.
That's like a Category 5, isn't it?
I had never seen trees bend that way.
Jeez.
We had a half a dozen trees down around our house, and trees were blown over with the roots sticking up in the air. Signs are down. It's just unbelievable.
What's your take on the Pentagon launching a task force to investigate UFO sightings?
Well, that's a great thing if they actually do it, but mm-hmm. what happened is they did that in 1948 with Project Sign, and it eventually evolved into a public relations outfit where we're going to deny everything and slap idiotic explanations onto sighting reports, no matter how good those reports might be. We're just not going to pay any attention to them and label them as misidentifications and hoaxes and illusions and delusions and every other thing without coming out and saying, you know, we really don't know what that is. And maybe that would be the proper answer. We don't know what it is. Could be an alien spacecraft, could be something that's just so unidentifiable to the witness, even though it's a natural phenomenon of some kind, but we just don't know. And they kind of were abhorred by that idea that they would have to admit, we don't know.
Let's hope it's different this time around. What's your gut tell you?
It's not going to be any different. Why would it be any different? I know Rich Dolan and a lot of people talk about disclosure.
Yeah.
I don't think disclosure is going to happen until the aliens land, in which case there's going to be no way to deny it. But I don't think the government has any incentive to disclose anything they know.
I told Steve Bassett that years ago, Kevin, because, you know, he's been pounding away for disclosure. And I said, I just don't think government's going to come out and tell us. It's not going to happen that way.
No. No, I don't think so either. I thought we were getting closer when the Navy videotapes showed up.
Right.
And I thought, well, this may be a step toward disclosure. And on my blog, I talked about that a little bit, but then, of course, all the skeptical ideas came out, and there was some controversy about Alonzo and what his role was and all these other things coming out, and it looks like we've taken a step back from there. So I think disclosure is not in the hands of our government. It's in the hands of the aliens, and when they decide they're going to disclose their presence in a way that's going to be irrefutable, that's when we'll have disclosure.
What are you working on these days, Kevin?
Well, I just finished a book called The Best of Project Blue Book, and my next book coming out next May is called UFOs, the Dark State, and the Air Force OSI. So, I haven't been working on that for the last few days because we have no electricity.
You have nothing. Well, great. Well, we'll get you back on then, too, when that other one comes out. But tell me about Project Blue Book. I mean, this was started a long time ago, headed up by the consultant, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who, after he was done with Blue Book, became a staunch believer. And tell me, what were you able to find out?
What I did was I looked at some of the best cases in the Project Blue Book files, and I was able to bring what we've learned since the closing of Blue Book to bear on those sightings so that I could add additional information. For example, the best example is Lonnie Zamora's sighting. We've said for years that Lonnie Zamora in Socorro, New Mexico, the landing in April of 19...
The police officer, the late police officer.
Yeah, wow. 1964. Was single case, a single witness. It was just Lonnie Zamora. That's the only real witness we had. We had a car with passengers, a tourist in it that may or may not have seen something. Nobody able could find them. And I was talking to Ben Moss and Tony Angio about the Socorro case, and they said, well, you know, people reported it to the police before Lonnie Zamora had seen anything. And I said, you check the police records. And I never got a good answer from them on that question. So I went back to the Project Blue Book files, and I was reading through that, and there was a guy named Richard Holder, Captain Richard Holder, an Army officer who was stationed at White Sands, and his duty station happened to be closer to Socorro than it was Alamogordo. So he lived in the Socorro area. So within 90 minutes of Zamora's sighting, Holder is interviewing Zamora along with a FBI agent. And in the Project Blue Book files, there's a half-page report from Holder, and he mentions in there that three people had called the police station prior to Zamora going out and seeing this thing. And I'm thinking, nobody followed up on that in 1964? Socorro's a small enough town.
That's
you know
right.
The path it was following based on what Lonnie Zamora said. You should have been able to find these people, but nobody bothered to do that. And that's one of the things you can bring to bear on it. Well, it's really no longer a single witness case. We have a police report or a report from this Captain Holder telling us that people had called the police station about something in the sky. So it kind of corroborates Lonnie Zamora's tale of seeing the landed UFO, the two creatures, the two beings, before it took off into the distance. So,
what was Zamora sent out there based on the witnesses calling in, or did he just stumble across it?
He stumbled across it. He was chasing a speeder through Socorro and heard a roar in the sky and thought a dynamite shack that he knew was on the outskirts of town had exploded. So he was driving out toward that, and he came up over a rise and saw down below him this object he thought at first was an overturned car, and he got down to approach it and discovered that it wasn't an overturned car. It was a egg-shaped object, and there were two beings standing outside that. And when they saw him, they sort of reacted to it, ran around to the back of the craft. There was a banging, like a hatch being closed, and the thing takes off with a roar into the sky. There's landing traces there, impressions from the landing gear. There was some kind of a chemical rocket that helped lift the thing up that burned the ground, but there was no residue from that when they analyzed the materials that they were able to collect. They couldn't find what kind of accelerant or what kind of propulsion system it had. So there was good evidence, physical evidence. You had a credible source in Lonnie Zamora. Now we've learned about these other people that saw something. And then the next day in La Madera, New Mexico, there was a similar sighting, and the Air Force kind of just didn't want to have anything to do with it. Hynek wanted to go to La Madera to interview those witnesses, and the Air Force said, no, you can't do it. You have to come home from Socorro. So the investigation of the Socorro case was kind of muffed from the very beginning, and I was able to go back and look through some of the records, talk to people in Socorro who knew Lonnie Zamora. There was a big controversy about the symbol that he saw on the side of the craft, and talked to some of the people that were involved in all of that sort of stuff. So I could bring that information to bear on the case that is, it appears in the Project Blue Book files, and add that information and make it a much, much stronger case than it had been or what we thought it had been.
Project Blue Book ceased in 1970. Why do you think they stopped it, or at least officially stopped it?
They were catching all kinds of flack. They were, when they would make a pronouncement of what a case was, people would just laugh at them. And you mentioned Dr. Hynek made the pronouncement of swamp gas in the Michigan sighting.
Oh, I was in Michigan at the time. I remember that.
And to be fair to Dr. Hynek, he had just arrived and he's thrown into a press conference, and this is borne out in the documentation. And they said, what do you think it is? And he said, well, it sounds like swamp gas. And given the descriptions he had been given, that would be a perfectly logical explanation. Once you get into the case and you start listening to what the witnesses had to say, and the multiplicity of witnesses and a bunch of locations that weren't near swamps, you realize that that swamp gas explanation simply didn't work. But, I mean, Hynek showed up and didn't have access to all that information when he had to meet with the press. So he gave kind of a shoot-from-the-hip explanation, and it caught
Oh, my God, it haunted him.
Yes, yes, absolutely, and made the Air Force investigation look bad. If you go back through the history of Blue Book and you read through the administrative files, you can see from the after the Robertson panel, that CIA-sponsored investigation into UFOs that decided they needed to debunk it and there was nothing to it, in 1953, you can see that the Air Force wanted to get rid of Project Blue Book, but they couldn't do it. There was all this interest in UFOs, and they were trying to dissuade people from being interested in it. And you read all of that information. You see the setup with the Condon Committee, and I do talk about that in the book a little bit. There was a letter from a Lieutenant Colonel Hippler that says, Condon Committee, what we want you to do when you accepted the grant is we want you to say something positive about the Air Force investigation, say that there's no threat to national security, and nothing more can be learned scientifically by studying UFOs, and we can close it down. That's exactly what the Condon Committee did. They spent 18 months looking into it. They decided there was no threat to national security. The Air Force had done a good job, and there was no reason to continue. So they shut it down officially. But we know at the same time there was something called Project Moondust.
That's right.
I found four case files in Project Blue Book that that mentioned moon dust. So we know there was a UFO component that way. But that information was inadvertently leaked into the public, and moon dust, with its UFO component, continued to investigate up till 1985 when the name was compromised.
Hold on for a second, Kevin. We're at a break. We'll come back and talk about your latest work, The Best of Project Blue Book. We're with Kevin Randall. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Kevin Randall. Kevin, so Project Blue Book stopped operating 50 years ago. Why now write the best of the Project Blue Book?
One of the problems was the files were classified or restricted so that we as civilians couldn't get into them. They were declassified and sent to the National Archives in 1976. But it's just recently that I think we've realized that it's a real gold mine out there, that there's a lot of good information in there if you can wade through all the nonsense that the Air Force threw out and some of the experts threw out about citing conclusions. And that was, you know, the whole point. Let's look at these cases and see what we can learn about them. Leveland springs to mind. And this was the case in 1957 where the object was seen close to the ground, stalled car engine, that sort of thing. I mean, we got a craft interacting with the environment, for crying out loud. It's multiple witness. There's witnesses at least 13 locations that talked about that. And so we can go back into that case now, and we can look at what the Air Force said, what NICAP, which was one of the civilian organizations investigating it, said, see who was right, who was wrong, and bring additional information to it. A guy named Don Burlinson, who lives coincidentally in Roswell, and Leveland is like 3 hours away by car from Roswell,
right,
did an investigation in 2001, and he was able to talk to the daughter of the sheriff. Now, the sheriff had said publicly, repeatedly, well, I saw a streak of light in the distance. Nothing happened. I didn't get a good look at it. You go back and you talk to the family, and they say, well, the sheriff was told by the Air Force not to talk about it. So we learn a little bit more about what they said, and that he got much closer to it, and he saw a oval-shaped or an egg-shaped object.
Was the Condon Committee from the University of Colorado, I believe,
yes,
was that a smokescreen?
Oh, absolutely. It was designed to specifically end the Air Force public investigation of UFOs, and that's exactly what they did. That was what their job was, and they did it.
And they did it, and they did it well, in terms of ending it.
And ending the public investigation, as we've now learned, of course, Project Moondust tells us that it didn't end then. When the name Moondust was compromised in 1986. Robert Todd wrote to them and asked for what the new name was, and they said, we can't tell you, it's properly classified. So it continued on beyond Moondust, and we heard inklings of the project, and then we, of course, learned what happened with the ATIP program and that sort of thing. So we realized there's been an ongoing government investigation of UFOs almost from 1946, actually, instead of Kenneth Arnold's sighting in 1947.
How many cases did they say were unidentified in the Project Blue Book?
Project Blue Book said they investigated some 12,000 cases, and about 701 of them were unidentified. The problem is...
All you need is one.
Well, but the real problem is, when you look at the Project Blue Book files, there's like 4,000 or 5,000 cases that are labeled as insufficient data for scientific analysis, which means they're not identified. They've just slapped a label on it, so it doesn't fall into the unidentified category. I talk about one of the cases in the book, where a guy had seen the object late at night. He flashed his light at it with pi, 3.14, because the only thing he could think about it, and got some kind of response. And he reported to the Air Force, and the Air Force labeled it insufficient data. And he wrote, what more data do you need? I told you everything I know. I gave you the directions. I gave you the times. I gave you the altitudes. I gave you all of this stuff. What more do you need? They finally labeled it as unidentified, which shows you if you, I guess, made enough noise, the Air Force would... reversed themselves, but they just they didn't bother with it. They didn't care. They just labeled it insufficient data. There was another cases in Florida, and I talk a little bit about this as well, where an Air Force major is required to investigate the case, and you can read from his report that he is just really annoyed at having this extra duty. He thinks it's absolutely ridiculous. He's making fun of the people who had seen the object, including Air Force personnel, being young, uneducated, stupid people seeing UFOs, and that comes across in the report, so you get an idea of the attitude of some of the people the Air Force was using to investigate the sightings.
June 24th, 1947, an American aviator and businessman is flying a small plane near Mount Rainier in Washington, and he reportedly sees nine unusual objects, and that began the Kenneth Arnold sightings. What do you think he saw, Kevin?
Well, the interesting thing about that is, I think at one point they were talking about it being the XB-35, which is the flying wing, but in that time frame, all the flying wings that they had were grounded because there were problems with the gearboxes. They were inherently unstable. The B-2 bomber is an upgraded version of the flying wing, but they have fly-by-wire computer computers keep the stability of the aircraft, but in the 1950s, they didn't have that. They crashed, but he didn't see that. He didn't see pelicans. He didn't see wisps of snow blowing off the peaks. He saw something very unusual. This is where we always say the modern era began, but it actually began earlier than that, and there's evidence that there was an unofficial investigation at Wright Field starting in December of 1946 about UFOs. Once we get to June of 1947 and Arnold's sighting, then it flips over into a more official investigation.
And ironically, a few weeks later, Roswell, New Mexico, that big event happens. They had to be tied together somehow.
I think that what happened is when Arnold made his sighting and it made the big splash, the government didn't know how to respond to it. They didn't know what it was. I think Ruppelt, who was one time the chief of Project Blue Book, was saying the Pentagon was in a panic. They didn't know what was going on. Suddenly, 2 weeks after Arnold, you've got something that fell at Roswell, and the whole attitude changes. And the next day, it's reported, I think, in July 1947 in the newspapers that the Roswell Army Airfield had captured a flying saucer. The next day, you read the explanations, well, it was just a weather balloon. But the important story was the Army and Navy moved at that point to suppress the stories of flying saucers whizzing through the atmosphere. So what changed between July 8th and July 9th that required the military to start attempting to suppress the stories of flying saucers? And they picked one up at Roswell, and they realized what was going on, they realized that they had to determine exactly what was going on, and they didn't need a lot of outside influences influencing their investigations, which is why they started to suppress the stories, get the public uninterested in the flying saucers, and they could move into a secret arena and determine exactly what was going on.
We're with Kevin Randall. His latest book is called The Best of Project Blue Book. What about Colonel Howard McCoy? What was his role in all of this?
Howard McCoy is an interesting guy. He starts out during the Foo Fighters in World War II, the lights and things that the pilots and the airmen were reporting.
They saw these little disc-type objects flying all over the place, didn't they?
Disc-shaped objects, balls of light, they would fire at them. The bullets would disappear into the balls of light, and nothing would come out. They followed the formations. The idea, the fear was it was some kind of an access secret weapon, so they were very concerned about it. McCoy was involved in the investigation of that, and when the war ended, the immediacy of trying to learn what it was ended as well. Nobody cared anymore what it was because the war's over. They're not a threat anymore. Then McCoy shows up in the ghost rockets here in 1946. You know, a year later, he's investigating the ghost rockets. He's involved in that. When we get to late in 1946. He is called by Nathan Twining, who was the Air Materiel Commander at the time, and set up an unofficial investigation into these lights, these objects, what are being seen, because it's being seen around the world, still going on. And then, of course, when the Arnold sighting took place, McCoy is brought in officially to investigate that. And the letter that Twining writes in September of 1947, which is the phenomena is something real and not illusionary and fictitious. That letter was probably authored by Howard McCoy. So he is
interesting.
He is involved in all this phenomenon up to 1947 and then beyond that. So he kind of controls the flow of information and where the investigations are going.
Did the late Philip Corso's name pop up in any of this?
No.
Not at all.
No. This is prior to Corso, and if he was involved in anything at all, it wouldn't have been in the purview of Project Blue Book. There was nothing about Corso and his activities in Project Blue Book in the administrative files or the OSI files that are attached to the Project Blue Book files that you can look at.
Were the actual Blue Book files now, Kevin?
They're at the National Archives. When they were declassified in 1976, they went first to the Air Force Archives at Maxwell Air Force Base. And we need to take a bow, debt of gratitude to Jack Webb, because he's the one that got them all microfilmed. He was wanted to do a series called Project UFO back in the 1970s.
Really?
And so he paid to have them all microfilmed so he could have a copy of the file. So we got to reach out to Jack Webb and say thank you, Jack, on that one. But they went to Maxwell Air Force Base. A friend of mine, Robert Cornett, and I were able to access the files there because we learned they were there. I was writing UFO articles. And I'd call the editor, and he'd, I'll call you back later, and it was hard to get through them. And I called him one day, and I said, I can get the Project Blue Book files. And my editor didn't call. His boss called immediately and started telling me what I should look for in the files. I didn't tell him that anybody who knew they were at Maxwell Air Force Base would probably go look at them. We were able to do that. The first thing we did when we got there, we got a hold of the indexes, and it had all the names of the people in it. And we went through all the unidentifieds and wrote down all the names of the people so we could put the names back in the files when they were released publicly to the National Archives, where they are now. The Air Force went through and redacted all the names.
Were the files blacked out like we see so many documents these days?
Just mostly the names were taken out. The witnesses' names were taken out. And the one that really cracked me up is the Arnold sighting. And there's a telephone interview with Arnold and a Air Force officer. And they've even blacked out his initials, K.A., but in grease pencil on the first page in letters that are about a half inch wide, it says Arnold sighting. So
that's interesting.
Well, they didn't do a very good job of blacking out the names. I've rarely found a file where if I went through it carefully, I couldn't find a name.
When I hear Lubbock, Texas, I think of the home of the late Buddy Holly. But there was a UFO case in Lubbock called the Lubbock Lights. Tell us about that.
This was a series of sightings that started with a group of college professors sitting around. It was Texas University, it's Texas Tech now, and saw these lights fly over, and they didn't get a good look at them, and they thought, well, maybe they'll come back, and they set up all these kind of observations of these lights flying over. A guy named Carl Hart Jr. took photographs of them a couple of days later, and the photographs have never really been explained. He took five photographs of a V-shaped formation. It seems it was independent lights in it because they moved in relation to one another. I was in Lubbock on my way to Roswell. I was actually in Lubbock and doing part of the Roswell investigation, and on a lark, I looked his name up in the phone book, and he was there. So I called him and chatted with him about that. And I said, what did you see? Knowing that teenagers who took photographs of UFOs usually came out years later and admitted, I faked the thing. And there's many, many famous photographs where that's happened. I said, what did you photograph? Figuring, he's 60 years old now. He'll tell me what he saw. And he says, I still don't know what I photographed. So it's kind of unusual. The Air Force explanation, it was birds flying in formation.
Birds.
I talked to the DNR, the Department of Natural Resources at Lubbock and all of this stuff. They said the only birds in the area that flew in formations like that was a duck. And it had a dark bill, so it wouldn't be reflecting the city lights as the Air Force had proposed. They said, it was plover. Plover don't fly in V formations. And we've got those photographs that Hart took, and you've got the photographs that are unexplained. A professional photographer from the newspaper, I think the guy's name was Ham, was on the top of the building of the Avalanche Journal trying to photograph the lights as they went over. He was unable to do it. He could never get a good photograph of the birds and all of that sort of thing. So it sort of shows that Hart, photographs were very, very important. And that's one of the things in the Project Blue Book I was able to do. I was able to talk to Carl Hart Jr. about what he saw. I talked to Al Chop, who was in the radar room during the Washington National sightings, all the sightings over Washington, D.C. in 1952 that got the my favorite headline in a newspaper, Cedar Rapids Gazette, banner headline in July of 1952 says, Saucers Swarm Over Capitol. It's like a headline out of a science fiction movie. And I was talking to Al Chop. I talked to Dewey Fournet. Both of them were in the radar room on the second night when objects were there, and I got their opinions of what they saw, so I could bring that to bear in the book that really hadn't been done before, where people had talked to these kinds of people. So I was able to talk to a lot of people who were involved in the sightings in today's environment, what they saw, what they did, and how they reacted to it, as opposed to what the Air Force said during their investigations.
Kevin, at this point, how many great investigators have passed on? What percent? A high number?
of civilian or military?
Both, probably.
I think we're getting down to the point where we have very few of the old guard left who are doing really good jobs.
Yeah.
And the new guard doesn't seem to be that interested in UFOs. They've gone off in other tangents. We don't really see the kind of investigative enthusiasm that we did in years past. I know Don Schmidt and I spent an awful lot of time in Roswell, many trips to Roswell. He and Tom Carey carrying on with that, doing some good work there. But we don't see that kind of dedication, and you can go online and get a lot of the stuff now. You know, you look at the internet and you can do your investigation on the internet. And the internet's a valuable tool.
Sure.
But there's nothing really like sitting in the room and talking to the people who are involved.
Yeah, they're the ones that are dying off.
I look at my telephone directory with the names of the Roswell witnesses, and they're virtually all gone.
Yep, that's a shame. And you know, and even the late Stanton Friedman, who was really into Roswell, we've lost him over a year ago. I mean, it's just. It's tragic. Kevin, where do people get the book, The Best of Project Blue Book?
Amazon.com. Where else?
Where else? My God. And it's, you know, it's a perfect way to shop when people are trapped in their homes or their apartments or wherever they may live. Let's take some phone calls with you, Kevin, when we come back in just a moment. Kevin Randall with us, one of the world's greatest UFO investigators. His latest book is called The Best of Project Blue Book. He's got a couple others out there, Roswell in the 21st Century, Encounter in the Desert. He's got a new one coming out next year as well, but we'll talk to him about that next year. Let's take your calls when we come right back.